This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Boomtown, the fantastical saga of Oklahoma City, its chaotic founding, its apocalyptic weather, its purloined basketball team, and the dream of becoming a world-class metropolis. This is the author, Sam Anderson. It seems unnecessary to define an explosion, for everyone knows what it is. A loud noise and the sudden going away of things from the place where they have been. Tenny L. Davis, The Chemistry of Powder and Explosives. Some things are simultaneously too boring and too exciting to write about. John Ashbery, Valentine. Prologue. Killer of the Killer. Red Kelly was the man who killed the man who killed Jesse James. That is, in 1892, 10 years after Jesse James was shot in the back while dusting off a picture frame, Red Kelly hunted down his killer, Bob Ford, and shot him in the throat with a double-barreled shotgun. This did not happen in Oklahoma City. The famous events, the front-page news items, rarely ever do. It happened in Creed, a silver mining boomtown in Colorado. Ford was running a saloon in a tent. Kelly walked in, said, "Hello, Bob," and shot Ford as soon as he turned around. He expected to be celebrated as a national hero for this. Jesse James, after all, was a legend whose righteousness had only grown and grown in the years since his death, and Bob Ford was, as the folk song says, a dirty little coward. Instead, Red Kelly was sentenced to 99 years in prison. He did not get the star treatment he felt he deserved. Kelly was not a first-tier outlaw, one of those infamous larger-than-life anti-heroes who robbed the robber barons and blurred the boundaries between good and evil. He was not Billy the Kid, or John Wesley Hardin, or Ned Kelly, or Smokin' Royce Young. He was not Butch, or Sundance, or, obviously, Jesse James. Red Kelly was a D-list outlaw, very far down the folk hero food chain. He was a vigilante vigilante, the backup to the backup. Kelly ended up serving 10 years of his sentence before he managed to get himself released. He left Colorado and headed down to Oklahoma City, where the outlaw action was rumored to be hot. It was 1904 by then, the start of a new century, and the Wild West was shrinking. Some vestige of it had survived, however, in Oklahoma. Oklahoma City was only 15 years old, and after a brief lull, booming again. For a criminal, its red light district was a safe haven of arson, murder, gambling, drunkenness, bribery, and prostitution. Shootouts could be enjoyed indoors or out. Around the time of Red Kelly's arrival, a man called the Armless Wonder, whose arms were reportedly 5 and 7 inches long, cocked his gun with his chin and shot a man who owed him money. There were riots so wild that whole buildings were left permanently infused with bullets. In a popular saloon, someone poured alcohol into a man's boots and lit them on fire, burning his feet so badly they had to be amputated. Red Kelly fit right in. He was angry, petty, and violent. He had big ears and about 3 mustaches worth of mustache. He skulked around Oklahoma City's trouble spots wearing a long overcoat, even in hot weather, with a revolver in each of his front pockets. The tips of his mustache were so long and pointy they almost looked prehensile, like they might reach out and take things off store shelves. One day, in the course of his skulking, Kelly was stopped and questioned by the Oklahoma City police. They weren't arresting him. They made no accusations, filed no charges, and allowed him to go freely on his way. But the questioning alone was enough to offend Red Kelly. He had been a lawman once, a deputy marshal in Colorado, not to mention the man who killed the man who killed motherfucking Jesse James, and he believed that he deserved more respect. This injustice would not stand. Kelly promised his underworld friends that he would take revenge, as soon as he possibly could, on the Oklahoma City police. His opportunity came on the very next day, January 13th, 1904. Officer Joe Burnett was patrolling a notorious strip of saloons and brothels when he happened to pass Kelly in the street. "Hi, Red," Burnett said. This, a friendly greeting from a passing policeman in broad daylight, was more than Kelly was willing to endure. He drew his gun. The fight that ensued was both ridiculous and deadly, a rare combination. Officer Burnett grabbed Kelly's wrist and managed to hit him twice on the head with his club. Kelly fired wildly into the air. The two men wrestled to a stalemate. For 15 minutes, they dragged each other down the street. It was a slow-motion death struggle. Kelly tried to yank his wrist free, while Burnett hung on, literally, for his life. At some point, one of Kelly's friends came out of a saloon and shot at Burnett, but he missed and ran away. Kelly, in his desperation, started biting Burnett's ears. As he bit, he fired his gun so many times, so close to Burnett, that its explosions lit the policeman's clothes on fire. People gathered in the street to watch. Things were getting terrible. Kelly was biting actual chunks out of Burnett's ears. Burnett kept asking bystanders for help, shouting that he was a policeman. They just answered, "How do we know for sure?" You didn't really know such things in 1904 in Oklahoma City. The fight scraped on through the center of town. It ended up a full 75 feet from where it had started, in an empty lot. Burnett was smoldering and bleeding. Kelly was shooting and biting. They were a perfect balance of control and chaos. Uninterrupted, they might have fought each other until both died of natural causes. But then, suddenly, by chance, the scales tipped. Across the street, the front door of a warehouse opened. A man stepped out. It happened to be one of Officer Burnett's friends. He sprinted over and grabbed Red Kelly by the wrist. "Is his gun empty?" he shouted. Kelly, defiant to the end, fired again and said, "Does it sound like it's empty?" Now that someone else had taken over the interminable duty of clinging to Red Kelly's murderous wrist, Burnett was finally able to draw his own gun. He fired. Boom. Kelly died in a gigantic pool of blood just off of First Street. This incident, along with many others more or less like it, titillated local newspaper readers for weeks. Oklahoma City police officer Joe Burnett was now the killer of the killer of the killer of Jesse James. This audio program is a history of Oklahoma City. That may strike you as unnecessary or unfortunate. If so, I would understand. In the larger economy of American attention, Oklahoma City's main job has always been to be ignored. When non-Oklahomans need to think about the place, we tend to fall back on cliches. Teepees, wagon trains, the Dust Bowl, country music, college football, methamphetamine, radical anti-government politics. There is always, of course, the Broadway musical Oklahoma, with its soaring anthems of manifest destiny. Every 5 or 10 or 20 years, the world is forced to pay serious attention to Oklahoma because something terrible has happened there, a tornado or a bombing or an economic collapse. But then we go back to ignoring it. This is natural. We can't pay attention to everything. You have to know how to look past a place. And Oklahoma City, in the grand scheme of things, is a very easy place to look past. This changed for me, very suddenly, in the summer of 2012, when I was sent to Oklahoma City on a magazine assignment, to write about the city's improbable new pro basketball team, the Thunder, which had evolved with almost unbelievable speed from a morally tainted laughingstock to one of the most powerful collections of talent in sports. That narrow assignment widened very fast. As soon as I got near Oklahoma City, I felt a mysterious inner needle beginning to vibrate. A needle that, in all of my journalistic wanderings, I had never noticed before. I wasn't sure what it measured or if it measured anything at all, but there it was, moving. For the next several years, I followed the vibrations of that needle wherever they happened to lead. That turned out to be all over Oklahoma City, to rock concerts, house parties, a megachurch, an abandoned skyscraper, locker rooms full of semi-naked men, the opening of a time capsule, the 2016 NBA Western Conference Finals, and a TV news station weather center in the middle of a deadly storm. I walked under some of the most beautiful skies I've ever seen, wide blueberry cream regions of stretching alien vastness, and under some of the most horrifying. I was lied to cheerfully dozens of times, often by people I came to consider friends. I got severe sunburns and blisters. For the first time in my life, I began to take seriously the occult power of the number 13. I sat shotgun for days and days, while different Oklahomans drove me around the city, saying wildly divergent things about exactly the same territory. I committed vandalism. I found myself formulating, over the course of many months, a question that seemed to be, on multiple levels, the key to the entire place. Is it possible to control an explosion? The result is Boomtown. From a distance, Oklahoma City looked like almost nothing. Up close, it turned out to be about almost everything. It became obvious immediately that the new basketball team was deeply entangled in every other aspect of the place, its politics, its history, its economics, its weather, and that this nexus of Oklahoma things was further inextricable from an even larger nexus, certain fundamental tensions in the DNA of democracy itself. Oklahoma City was like a laboratory for unavoidable American problems. What does an individual gain, and what do they lose, when they become assimilated into a group? How does something as messy as a mass of people ever organize itself into a functional system? Or is it always ultimately destined to fail? I've come to believe, after my time there, that Oklahoma City is one of the great weirdo cities of the world, as strange in its way as Venice or Dubai or Versailles or Pyongyang. It is worth paying attention to, on its own terms, independent of any news cycle, strictly for the improbability of what exists there all the time, every day. It is a place where a golden geodesic dome sits down the street from a tiny building with a giant milk bottle on its roof, where a thin-shell, concrete, retro-futuristic church is known affectionately, to certain locals, as the City Titty. It is a place where a blacksmith once died of the hiccups. I'm not going to argue that Oklahoma City is an ideal city. Not many people, outside of certain boosterish sections of the city itself, would be willing to go that far. But it's the kind of city that, in its excesses, its imbalances, its illusions, its overcorrections, its lunges of pride and insecurity, its tragedies, and its improbable achievements, says something deeper about the nature of cities, about human togetherness, than a more well-rounded or traditional city ever could. It is an unlikely, unreasonable, and arbitrary place, a city that came into being outside the normal run of history, and so, in a sense, a pure city. For the purposes of this audio program, and with apologies to Charleston, Austin, the Portlands, Fort Worth, Indianapolis, Chattanooga, Charlotte, Memphis, San Antonio, and of course Seattle, always special apologies to Seattle. Oklahoma City is the great minor city of America. The main story of Boomtown spans roughly 1 year in the life of Oklahoma City, from perhaps the most controversial trade in NBA history to the widest tornado ever recorded. Nesting inside that story are innumerable other stories, both famous, Ralph Ellison, Kevin Durant, and less so, civil rights leader Clara Looper, civic booster Stanley Draper, NBA bench player Daniel Orton. Because every Oklahoma City moment tends to be connected to every other, the narrative drops into and out of history. The city has existed for only a little over a single human lifespan, not yet 130 years. But in that time, it has lived the life of many cities. From its very first moment, OKC has always wanted to hurry up, to exist somehow in its own glorious future. It has never been able to do so, of course. The future it hurls itself into is never the future it was fantasizing about, and so it hurls itself again. This makes the present feel like history. OKC is a place where time does not work properly. It crawls, then lurches forward, then piles up on itself, then pauses, then slides backward, then repeats itself, then freezes, then stumbles forward again. On the city's very first afternoon, in 1889, its population exploded from 0 to 10,000. To leave a familiar locality for a few hours, one settler wrote, was to never find it again, so rapidly did the face of the young city change. In the 20th century, the skyline froze for 30 years, then was largely destroyed, intentionally, in less than a decade. You can't operate in 1964 with buildings designed for 1925, the mayor told his people. The city decided it needed to be bigger, so for absolutely no good reason, it annexed enough land to make itself the largest city by land area in the entire world. Several years ago, a skyscraper rose up out of an old parking lot to dominate Oklahoma City seemingly overnight. What I'm telling you, what I will continue to tell you, is that time does not make sense here. Just outside City Hall, a 9-foot-tall statue of a dead civic leader bears this inscription. Look around you. What you see today was his tomorrow, yesterday. If Red Kelly and Officer Burnett were to have their fight in Oklahoma City today, 114 years later, it would happen right in the heart of a very different downtown. The zone of sin and degeneracy in which Kelly first attacked Burnett was later cleared to build grand municipal buildings. Kelly and Burnett would have dragged each other, biting and fighting, along the backside of the Devon Tower, an 850-foot glass skyscraper that is the most literal possible monument to the city's grandiose self-image. They would have seen, on passing cars and plate glass windows and the t-shirts of passers-by, infinite logos of the Oklahoma City Thunder, the basketball team that has become the international face of the city. Bystanders to the modern brawl would not be cowboys and ruffians, but city workers in suits and ties, heading back from lunch meetings, at which they had enjoyed scarlet quinoa with roasted carrots and local honey. Joining them would be self-employed hipsters who'd spent the morning in the nearby coffee shops, plotting political action and designing websites for one another. Plus homeless people heading toward the bus station, plus possibly even tourists coming to see the bombing memorial before getting slightly drunk at the chain restaurants in Bricktown. Today, Kelly and Burnett would have wrestled over nice pavement instead of dust. They would have scraped their way past a large rack of bicycles, part of a municipal bike rental program called Spokies. Their fight would have ended not in an empty lot, but right in the middle of the new public library, a clean, white, curving building with an elaborately choreographed fountain outside. Instead of a warehouse, Officer Burnett's rescuer would have come running out of the county courthouse, a stately New Deal monolith with civic quotes carved onto its limestone face. He who has most zeal and ability to promote public felicity, let him be the servant of the public. Red Kelly's gigantic pool of blood would have gushed out of him, and, as his eyes glazed over, as he considered for the last time the cruel injustices of justice, soaked into the public library's carpet, creating a nightmare for the cleaning staff. Red Kelly's name, it turns out, was not even actually Red Kelly. It was Edward O'Kelly. People called him Red because of his Irish hair. After the fight, his body was buried in an unmarked grave far uptown in what would eventually become Fairlawn Cemetery, the final resting place of many of OKC's most revered city fathers. Officer Joe Burnett, it was said, never fully recovered from his injuries. He died 13 years later, and was buried in the same cemetery. Today, this cemetery is not far uptown at all. It's a short, easy drive from the scene of the crime, and is now adjacent to the fashionable Paseo Arts District, where you can go on art walks the first Friday of every month, and patronize funky shops with decorative knight's armor and patchouli incense and earrings made out of glass-encased cicada wings, where you can stand in an art gallery eating cheese cubes in an atmosphere of provincial cosmopolitanism, while admiring expressive paintings with titles like Life in the Harmonious Balance of Things Without Fear of Death, all while young people with dreadlocks dance in drum circles on the street outside, oblivious to your very existence, a closed society that involves only the drummers and the sacred all-encompassing universe itself, not any of the actual boring people around them. Boom, boom, transcendence. Boom, boom, patchouli. Boom. Return with me, if you will, to Oklahoma City at the end of the summer of 2012, right around the moment everything was, once again, about to change. Part 1. Time. We cannot think of a time that is oceanless. T.S. Eliot, The Dry Salvages. Thunder results from the superheating of the air around the lightning bolt to about 5 times the temperature of the sun, all within a few millionths of a second. Gary England, Those Terrible Twisters. I just don't have time to worry about it now. I'll put it in file number 13. Clara Looper, Behold the Walls. A Visitor's Guide to Oklahoma City. Welcome to Oklahoma City. It's been a long day. You've taken two flights to get here, possibly three. You've eaten unfortunate foods. You fell asleep at the Memphis airport somehow, with your head leaning hard against the wall. You slept so deeply that the woman working at the gate had to actually come shake you awake just before the plane took off. Don't be embarrassed. It's all part of the long, unglamorous process of getting yourself to a minor airport out in the middle of the country. But now you've made it. Welcome. Come along, stretch your legs. The OKC airport is small, so you'll have no trouble finding your way around. First, get yourself a car. You won't be able to survive here without one. Go to the rental desk. The clerk will be curious to know why you are here, all the way from wherever you have come. Tell him. If the conversation lulls, you can talk about the Thunder. He will be a fan. He might ask you about the James Harden crisis. Will Harden stay or will he go? Tell him that no one knows for sure, obviously, but that if you had to bet, you'd bet he'll stay. The young man will encourage you to pay an extra $10 per day to upgrade to a Mustang, a special deal, he'll tell you. But do your best to resist the temptation, because when you get out to the parking garage, you'll suddenly remember what a Mustang looks like a shark with a fat snout, bullet-nosed, and swaggering. Politely refuse and collect the keys to some kind of nondescript sedan. Walk out of the terminal. On your way out, you'll see a statue. Will Rogers, the folksy sage of the Great Plains, cast in bronze, wearing a bronze cowboy hat, riding a bronze horse, with a bronze lasso frozen in the air beside him. The whole airport is named after him, Will Rogers World Airport. World is meaningless here because there are actually no international flights. It's just another example of one of Oklahoma City's defining behaviors, trying to make itself seem bigger than it is. The city conducts itself, whenever possible, like a hiker threatened by a bear in the woods, hysterically exaggerating its size. Before you move on, take a moment to stop and look at the statue. Now is perhaps not the time to think about the fact that Will Rogers died in a plane crash. Here's another peculiarity of arriving in Oklahoma City. The statue will always be the same, but the sky over it will always be different. Most places have one sky. Oklahoma City has about 12. There seem to be many different vectors up there, completely unrelated to one another, happening all at once. Sometimes you'll see silent lightning blinking very high in one region, while smooth white clouds slide around low behind you. Will Rogers' lasso, if you look through it, might be holding the sun, might be holding some ragged cirrus clouds, might be holding a volcanic piece of dusk. Once you've come to grips with the sky, move on from the statue, walk into the parking garage, pick up your rental car, steer it out onto the streets. Congratulations. You are now driving in Oklahoma City, an activity as characteristic as poling a gondola around Venice or weaving a moped through the crowds of central Marrakesh. You've driven cars elsewhere, but it will never have felt exactly like this. Oklahoma City is the natural habitat of cars. In normal cities, cars feel slightly out of place, like zoo animals, pacing narrow roads between mobs of pedestrians. Here in Oklahoma City, cars can stretch, roar, and run free. Many of the city's neighborhoods lack sidewalks, intentionally, as a symbol of status, because walking was considered to be outmoded, primitive, impoverished, a little sad, an activity that might even distract the cars or offend them. You will hear while you are here two basic axioms about driving in OKC, each of which seems to violate the laws of space-time, but each of which is true. 1. Even traffic jams move the speed limit. 2. Everywhere is only 15 minutes away. Drive. The airport roads are nice and new. They take you out under the wide skies. You are moving like a smooth cloud. You will notice out your windows that Oklahoma City has no topography to speak of. Everything is flat in every direction. This is because it was once the bottom of an ancient ocean. Keep looking around. Before you've even left the airport, you will see oil pumps working along the side of the road. Oklahoma is completely devoted to sucking fossil fuels up out of the ground and unembarrassed about its devotion. How else would it be possible to enable all of this wonderful driving? You will pass billboards for drilling equipment, and when you get into town, you will see active oil pumps in people's backyards. The state capitol building had a working oil derrick in front of it for many decades before it even had a dome. Keep driving. Leave the airport. Merge onto the freeway. Head toward the city center. There's signs, but you won't need them. You can navigate by the skyscraper. Skyscraper, singular, because there is, by modern standards, only the one. And it is so completely out of scale to the rest of the city that you can see it from everywhere else. It is nearly twice as tall as any other structure for 100 miles in every direction. It dominates downtown, glittering like an open blade. This is the Devon Tower, headquarters of one of OKC's biggest energy companies, a glass and steel monument to the miracle of hydraulic fracturing, aka fracking, the lucrative but controversial practice of destroying underground rock formations with a slurry of wet chemicals in order to release huge quantities of natural gas. But don't worry about the source of the wealth. You are here to enjoy Oklahoma City, the newly shiny center of which you are rapidly approaching. The skyscraper was meant to make the city seem big, but mostly it makes everything around it look small, thick, stocky, ancient, heavy, extremely Midwestern. It is perfect, however, for navigation. Ignore your GPS. It can't help you now. Keep your eye on the skyscraper. OKC is in the midst of a downtown renaissance, a growth whose improbability, after decades of busts and self-inflicted disappointments and unspeakable tragedies, has made the place almost legendary among contemporary American cities, and one result of this renaissance is constant construction. Streets are being rerouted, public art installed, medians expensively landscaped. Competing energy companies are building themselves increasingly grand headquarters. The old elevated highway that has loomed for nearly 50 years over the center of the city is now in the midst of being torn down. Its on-ramps and off-ramps end, eerily, in midair, entrances and exits to a ghost road that your GPS will keep trying to make you drive on. Ignore it. Drive on the actual roads. You'll cross over the Oklahoma River, healthy and full, although it is not technically a river anymore, because it has been corralled in a concrete trough that is fed and drained by dams at either end, which makes it more like a canal, really, or an inland lake. But at least now it is full of water, more dependable than the natural river, and as such it has become the anchor of a whole new area of town, the Boathouse District, which draws competitive rowers from all over the world, and which is getting ready to host an episode of American Idol. As you drive over the water, you might see Olympic kayakers training. Keep driving. Now that you're in Oklahoma City, it won't take you long to get to know the basic landmarks. You'll see signs for the tourist destinations. Bricktown, Stockyard City, Myriad Botanical Gardens, Chesapeake Energy Arena, the National Memorial. Everything is more or less right on top of everything else. Neighborhoods that sound like whole separate regions, Automobile Alley, Midtown, Sosa, are really just a few blocks apart. You could walk it all easily, if that's how things were done here. The Plaza District, one of the city's much-touted hip new neighborhoods, is basically two blocks of 16th Street. Oklahoma City is tiny and huge at the same time, sprawling and compressed. Residents often refer to it as the biggest small town in America, and that might be literally true. Although its population ranks only 29th in the contiguous United States, it is an absolute juggernaut in square mileage. Bigger by far than Los Angeles or New York or Chicago. Drive for 15 minutes in any direction and the city will begin to blend with the country. You'll think you've left town, but you haven't. Not even close. It will take many more miles of driving, much more open country, before you'll see a sign that says, out of nowhere, leaving Oklahoma City. But let's not do that. Why would we do that? This is Oklahoma City. Settle in. We'll be here for a while. Beard. The first time I saw James Harden up close, I was hypnotized by his beard. It was dense and black and shockingly large, A whole second head, practically, hanging under Hardin's regular head. A shadow head. I stared and stared. This was October 2012, during Thunder training camp. A hinge moment, although we didn't know it yet, on which the future of Oklahoma City was right about to turn. Hardin was talking. There was a hole in the middle of his beard for his mouth. But I could hardly pay attention to what he was saying because the beard, up close, was overwhelming. A real 99th percentile super mammalian face bush. A slow-motion testosterone explosion. I had seen it many times before, of course, on screens. Hardin was one of the NBA's rising young stars, and the Thunder was one of the great stories in all of professional sports. And so his beard had become, over the previous months, not only a local folk hero and symbol of the OKC Renaissance, but a full-on international brand, one of America's most famous hair things. There was a new Foot Locker commercial in which Harden's teammate Russell Westbrook squirted mustard on it, only for Hardin to rip the beard off to reveal, underneath, another equally lush backup beard. In person, however, the beard was something else entirely, more urgent and commanding and strange. It was wet from practice, and as Hardin spoke, it shifted and glistened, scattering tiny sparkles in every direction. Hardin was, at that moment, one of the youngest members of one of the youngest basketball teams in NBA history, a team that had improved so much, so quickly, over the previous few seasons, that it seemed destined soon to devour the league. The question in those days was not if the Thunder would win a championship, only if how many times. The previous season had been almost impossibly glorious, a 16-3 start, two players, the angelic Kevin Durant, the devilish Russell Westbrook, honored with selection to all NBA teams. A sixth Man of the Year award for Hardin, and all of it capped off by an underdog run to the NBA Finals. In July, all three of the Thunder's young stars were chosen to represent the United States in the Olympics, making OKC the first franchise in NBA history to send three players to the U.S. national team. There was no reason going forward for anything other than wild optimism. Unless, of course, unless James Hardin. Hardin and his beard were standing on that afternoon in the Thunder's new and extremely shiny $19 million practice facility. I was part of a large crowd of reporters, local and national, who had assembled to ask him questions. We were hoping to extract some new shred of intel, however small, about what was beginning to be thought of in OKC and beyond as the Hardin crisis. Would James Hardin stay with the Thunder, everyone was asking? Or would he go find his own team somewhere else? This threat had become, slowly, the story of the summer. It had begun to overshadow even the euphoric afterglow of that magical trip to the finals. The citizens of OKC were terrified, suddenly, that Hardin was going to leave them. "I wouldn't take anyone in the league over the beard," wrote a fan on the discussion board OKC Talk. "I will trade in all of my Thunder gear and wipe my memory of Thunder games if that happens." What we knew so far was only this. James Hardin was an unorthodox and magnetic young player, far better than anyone had reasonably expected, and his sudden rise towards stardom had elevated the Thunder from a very good team to a potentially great one. But it had also complicated things. Hardin came off the bench behind the exotic Swiss defensive specialist, Thabo Sefolosha. The problem was that Hardin was clearly too good to be a backup. He was a precious node of order among the chaos of an NBA game. You could give him the ball and get out of the way and trust him, almost every time, to do something dangerous with it. But the Thunder already had two ball-dominating stars in Westbrook and Durant. Was there really room for a third? Harden's rookie contract was set to expire at the end of the coming season, in the summer of 2013, but everyone expected him to solve things much sooner than that, like any second now, in the offseason of 2012, to keep the Thunder's momentum rolling. Early signs were good. "This team is like a family," Hardin said right after the finals ended. "We're really brothers. We hang out most of the time, every single day. You won't find any other team like this. I love it here." And yet, the weeks passed, and the Thunder took care of all kinds of other business, the draft, a contract extension for their head coach, and still, Harden's new deal did not get signed. The team picked up the 7'3" Hashim Thabeet, the tallest man in the NBA, as their backup center. They extended the contract of their power forward, Serge Ibaka, and filled front office positions. But they could not pin down James Harden. As the summer churned on, people in OKC remained optimistic. In July, at Team USA training camp, Sports Illustrated asked Harden about his plans. "I'm pretty, 100%, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be in Oklahoma City," he said. This was meant to be reassuring, but there was a large difference between pretty sure and 100%, and much of OKC's basketball future now hung in that zone. A Thunder blog, Welcome to Loud City, ran a poll about Harden's future, and 80% of respondents predicted that he would stay. That he either remains sixth man and keeps the Thunder as the most balanced team in the NBA, or moves to the starting shooting guard position and continues his ascent. The two pessimistic options, that Harden would refuse to sign or that OKC would trade him, sank right to the bottom, tied with only 13 votes apiece. August, then. The contract would get done in August. Harden would come home from the Olympics in London and sit down with the Thunder's management, and they would all focus hard and hash everything out. "If it's a max deal or even close to it," wrote Royce Young at Daily Thunder, "Harden is likely to sign on without thinking much about it." At the end of August, however, there was no contract. Harden turned 23, and photos emerged of his birthday party, and he did not look overly worried. He sat shirtless on a yacht, wearing a thick gold chain and a tiger print cowboy hat, clutching an open wine bottle, thoroughly entangled with a large crowd of women dressed in tight white clothes. The Oklahoman turned moralistic. "Oklahoma City," it wrote, "can save Harden from himself." September. Something somewhere seemed to be going wrong. Harden's services were worth a lot of money, of course, and so the team was offering a lot of money. But it was not offering the absolute maximum salary the NBA allowed, and this, for Harden, seemed to be a problem. He was refusing to sign. Whether it was a fatal and permanent error, or just a temporary glitch, no one could say, but the whole thing was dragging on worryingly long. As a player, Harden's greatest strength was his unpredictability. It was impossible to know at any given moment whether he would zig here or zag there. He was, at all times, a herky-jerky mystery. Now this same quality was torturing OKC. The city was paralyzed. Toward the end of September, as the crisis rose toward its climax, several citizens joked to me that they would be perfectly willing to vote for a temporary sales tax if the money would help convince Harden to stay. As soon as I laughed at this, it became clear that the citizens were not actually joking. I mentioned the hypothetical tax to the mayor, who agreed. Keeping Harden was not just a matter of basketball excellence, but of civic health. Losing him would be like pulling one of the downtown buildings out of the skyline. In the grand scheme of things, Harden was only the third best basketball player in the 29th largest city in America. At that moment, however, he seemed to be right at the center of everything. So there we stood in October, at the Thunder's practice facility, TV cameras rolling, voice recorders shoved toward James Harden's face, waiting for him to give us some kind of hint about whatever he might be thinking. I continued to stare into his beard. "There's a battle at point guard," one of the local reporters said. "But really, you've kind of taken control of the second team." This seemed like an innocuous bit of sports jargon, but it was actually, in code, an attempt to get at something crucial. The standoff between Harden and the Thunder was, at root, a question of control. Was there enough space in OKC for Harden to turn himself into the superstar he suspected he might be good enough to become? Were the Thunder's two bigger stars willing to yield some space to make room for him to do so? Were the team's fiscally conservative owners willing to pay Harden a superstar salary, thereby triggering the odious luxury tax, which would restrict the team's control over future decisions? And what did Harden really want, anyway? Did he want to win as part of the group in Oklahoma City, Or did he want his very own spotlight somewhere else, in a bigger city? All of this was implied, very subtly, in the local reporter's question. Hardin, however, was a master of control, and he refused to tip his hand. "We have three very good point guards on the team," he said with an incredible lack of inflection. "Three tremendous point guards who can all play that role and who are playing very well. They run the team. I'm just trying to fit in where I can." This was a blatant falsehood on several levels, and everyone standing there knew it, but we let the statement pass. Sports interviews are a special category of non-conversation, and this was particularly true in Oklahoma City, where a typical Thunder media session was a call and response of non-questions and non-answers, so relentlessly empty that it became almost profound, like the chanting of Buddhist monks. The culture of the organization in those early days was buttoned up, icy, strict, severe, a zone of bulletproof message control. Reporters traded whispered stories like dissidents in an authoritarian state. Every time anyone interviewed a player, a Thunder PR man would lurk in a nearby doorway, eavesdropping while Foe casually pretending to look at his phone like a bad CIA agent. This, I came to believe, was one of the essential functions of Harden's enormous beard, to give people something to stare at while the man himself said nothing, at great length, into all the microphones he was professionally obligated to speak into almost every day of his famous young life. Harden rattled off his cliches with all the enthusiasm of a third grader reciting the Gettysburg Address. I held my voice recorder out at arm's length toward Harden's mouth hole, like all of the other reporters, but I had no questions for him, no comments, no insights, no language. All I could do was stare into his beard. I had been sucked, like the rest of OKC, into the secret dimension of hair space. "Guys are doing a great job," Harden said. The beard looked like a wilderness on the edge of civilization. "Our main focus is defensively," he said. It seemed to contain somehow something important, an essence, a promise. "It's about maturity and taking care of your body," Harden said. No one asked James Harden, at least explicitly, the only thing everyone really wanted to know, which was whether or not he was going to stay. After several minutes of staring, I was able to break out of my hypnotic beard trance and look closely at James Harden's actual face. What I saw was disorienting. On TV, from a distance, Harden's beard gave him an air of wisdom, maturity, depth, mystique. Up close, however, there were things that didn't show up on screens. Human things, the micro-movements of eyes and mouth. It became clear to me, suddenly and viscerally, that James Harden was actually an extremely young man. He was a multimillionaire, an Olympic gold medalist, a burgeoning international celebrity, but he was also just barely not a teenager, a kid who happened to be wearing an incongruously giant beard. In person, up close, the beard looked like a disguise. It may as well have been rubber banded to his face. It was real, of course, but it implied things that weren't real. Most of all, it implied age. The beard was a big, curly pile of time. And time was the one thing James Harden and the Thunder no longer had. Middleness. Oklahoma City sits near the geographical center of the contiguous United States. But it is not even quite that. The real center is a little north, in Kansas. This gives OKC's middleness a not-quite quality. It is less America's belly button than the disturbing mole a few inches away. It's unclear, in fact, what part of the country Oklahoma actually belongs to. It is spoken of, variously, as part of the Southwest, Midwest, Bible Belt, and Heartland. It's easier to say what it is not. It's not the arid West, or the frigid North, or the humid South, or the Old World East. Instead, it is precisely where all of those things meet. Oklahoma is, inarguably, a flyover state. Planes fly over it all the time, and if you look out the window of one, you will see barrenness, crop geometry, vivid red dirt, all the markers of the Great Plains, the vast strip of flatness that runs right down the center of North America, of which Oklahoma is most certainly a part. The state is profoundly landlocked as a place can be. The Gulf of Mexico is 400 miles away, the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans more than 1,000. Oceanlessness has defined the place for millennia. In American popular culture, Oklahoma exists most powerfully as the epicenter of the Dust Bowl, a dryness so deep that it allowed the state's perpetual wind to lift up the entire surface of the land, trillions of grains at a time, and whip it away at very high speeds, clear across the continent. Oklahoma's dust went so far, so fast, that the people of New York City had to turn their lights on in the middle of the day, and sailors had to sweep their decks 300 miles out to sea. Thousands of Okies were forced to flee the blasted landscape, as dramatized canonically, to the dismay of the state's boosters, in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Oklahoma, however, was not always dry. For a long time, in fact, it was defined by its wetness. Before there was a United States, before there was even a North America, the land that would become Oklahoma sat right on the paleo equator, in the middle of the supercontinent, Pangaea. For 500 million years, off and on, Oklahoma City would have been at the bottom of an ancient sea. The sea filled up, then receded, then filled up, then receded, then filled up again. Its water was salty and warm. City residents would have included sharks and ancient clammy things called blastoids and brachiopods. Even during its relative dry spells, Oklahoma would have been wet and oozy. For roughly 20 million years, it was overrun by dimetrodons, lizards with giant sails on their backs that preceded the dinosaurs. None of this seems possible, but the fossil record is clear. Slowly, as the world's plates drifted and clashed, chains of mountains as tall as the Himalayas rose up around Oklahoma City, the Rockies to the west, the Wichita and Wachita and Arbuckle down south, the Ozarks to the northeast. And all of these dumped their mountain trash, mud, gravel, sand, clay, into Oklahoma, which was still not a state, of course, but only a flat trough between all of those dramatic peaks. The flotsam piled up and dried. Oklahoma was overrun at various times by dinosaurs, mammoths, rhinos, horses, and camels, all running wild, eating and mating, owning the land outright. Again, to someone who knows only modern Oklahoma City, to someone who has watched a tennis shoe float down the Bricktown Canal past Toby Keith's I Heart This Bar and Grill, none of this will seem possible. But it happened. For a while, the Gulf of Mexico came right up to Oklahoma's southern border. When the Rockies rose to their full height, they tilted the entire state like a table with a broken leg, pouring the ancient sea right off it. Glaciers formed and crawled around on the mountaintops, and when they finally melted, their water came gushing down across Oklahoma, forming its modern rivers. And that was basically that. What was left, after all this geological action, was a sun-baked sheet of primordial ooze sloping very gently from Colorado to Arkansas. It was a perfect place for grass to grow, such a nice place, in fact, that the grass and the soil became almost indistinguishable. A block of soil in Oklahoma was also a block of grass. Beneath that living surface, prairie dogs built their underground colonies, thousands and thousands of tunnels, some with false bottoms to fool predators, some leading to rough bedrooms and storerooms and bathrooms, all of them invisibly interconnected and meticulously organized into distinct neighborhoods. The largest prairie dog colonies covered hundreds of square miles, and above them, buffalo grazed by the millions. It was a teeming abundance of life, operating almost without restriction, farther than the eye could see. In other words, in American terms, Oklahoma was a wasteland. For many centuries, Europeans looking for value in the region had trouble finding any. In the 16th century, the Spanish explorer Francisco Vázquez de Coronado y Luján searched the wilderness of northern Mexico, which included Oklahoma, on his quest for the cities of gold. He didn't find them, and in his disgust, he wrote a letter back to Spain with the most damning indictment of the place he could think of. There is not any gold or any other metal, nothing but villages. But this, in fact, was the region's wealth. Its villages, all of those humans congregating and moving to live in concert with these vast spreads of land. Mammoth hunters evolved into foragers, who eventually became farmers living together in grass huts. Out east were the mound builders, a civilization organized enough to construct elaborate ceremonial mountains of dirt. Hundreds of years later, when archaeologists finally excavated the mounds, they found copper from the Great Lakes, shells from Florida, pottery from Nebraska, and obsidian from Mexico. Oklahoma had apparently been the hub of a huge network of trade, a central market for prehistoric North America. Here, then, was the secret genius of Oklahoma, the advantage of being stranded so far away from everything else, middleness. Oklahoma was where the mountains touched the plains, and where the plains turned into the tall grass prairie, and the tall grass prairie turned into the short grass prairie. And these contact zones created incredible richness, not only of flora and fauna, but of human cultures. Migrating herds intersected with rivers, which attracted tribes, which attracted trade routes, which attracted new explorers and their rivals, and the people they had enslaved, some of whom stayed behind and made new lives in the spreading wasteland. Oklahoma was a Hadron supercollider of a place. People and creatures were thrown together from distant points and at unpredictable angles, again and again and again and again. Despite its relative material poverty, its lack of obvious treasure, Oklahoma always had this unusual talent for improvised community. Besides, in the end, the conquistadors were wrong. Oklahoma's treasure had been there all along, just at a depth and in a form that they weren't equipped to exploit. Huge underground lakes of oil, dead black and untapped. This was yet another secret reward of middleness. By the time humans arrived, many eons of life had already thrived and died way out there in the center of the world. And now it sat hidden as a secret rich ooze waiting to be discovered. When it finally was, it would make Oklahoma one of the wealthiest places on Earth. But all of that would come in time. In the beginning. To understand all of the civic anxiety clustering around the Hardin crisis, the media frenzy and message board screeds, the wild speculation in grocery store lines, the backroom strategizing among politicians in City Hall, you first have to understand the wretched origins of basketball in Oklahoma City. In the beginning, things were very, very bad. I'm talking about October 2008. The Thunder was a brand new team, the newest in the NBA, and it was a laughingstock. Its players looked like clowns. Their uniforms were blue and orange. Not the classic, valiant, deep blue and orange of the New York Mets or Knicks, but lighter shades, somehow reminiscent of a coupon for an off-brand smoothie chain. And the logo. Design blogs were tripping all over themselves to make fun of the Thunder's logo. "I don't understand what is happening here," wrote one. "This isn't a fucking contemporary living room. Is that a clip art basketball?" Everything about the team seemed to confirm to the casual NBA fan the worst stereotypes about its new home. Oklahoma was provincial, amateur, terminally uncool. It could not be trusted to handle a piece of culture as sophisticated as a big league American sports team. Even the name, Thunder. What was that? The team had been named after sky noise? Sports writers hated the word because you couldn't tell if it was a collective or an individual noun. Were you supposed to write, "The Thunder is on an interminable losing streak"? Or the Thunder are on an interminable losing streak. Sometimes it was hard to tell whether the team itself, the actual assemblage of humans that took the floor together to play the sport, was a collective or an individual noun. The players didn't exactly congeal. The Thunder had one potential superstar in Kevin Durant, the universally beloved second pick in the 2007 draft, But Durant was still only 20, and he was skinny, inefficient, and often overmatched. He had such long arms that sports writers, trying to describe them, reached for inhuman metaphors. Pterodactyl wings. Capellini. Durant spent much of his early career peeling himself off the floor, being bullied by cynical grown-up defenders. He was joined in his misadventures by Jeff Green, a young potential sort of maybe star who projected eventually to be a nice wingman for Durant, but who replicated many of Durant's skills and therefore fit with him about as well as the fonts in the Thunder's logo. The rest of the roster was made up of cast-offs and role-players and lost-looking rookies. The Thunder was, not anything close to a winning team. And so the Thunder did not win. It did not win, and did not win, and did not win, and did not win. Of the team's first 32 games, the Thunder managed to win 3. This was not just bad, it was one of the worst starts in the history of sports. Talking heads debated, very seriously, whether or not OKC's clown-colored team was the most overmatched collection of basketball talent in league history. To make things worse, almost everyone outside Oklahoma was basking in the Thunder's failure, giddy with Schadenfreude. If any sports team deserved to be humiliatingly bad, people said, it was Oklahoma City's. This was because, like Oklahoma itself, like America for that matter, and actually like all of mankind, if you subscribe to the Christian theology that dominates OKC, the Thunder was cursed by the stain of its shameful origin. The Thunder, from the very beginning, had quite a lot to answer for. Ewing. In 1880, Oklahoma still did not exist. This was light years into the American experiment, more than a century after the Declaration of Independence, 15 years after the end of the Civil War. By then, all the states around it existed: Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, Texas, Colorado, but not Oklahoma. Certain people were getting tired of waiting. The land was there, of course. It was the same flat, grassy expanse that had been brewing and growing and oozing since the time of Pangaea. What we know today, however, as the state of Oklahoma, the pot-shaped chunk of map between Texas and Kansas, was back then something else entirely. It was known simply as Indian Territory. For decades, the U.S. government had been using Oklahoma as a storage area for its dispossessed indigenous peoples. As European settlers systematically invaded every last pocket of the continent, the tribes were forced out of their ancestral homes and into the sprawling wasteland. Oklahoma was the endpoint of all the many trails of tears. The Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, and dozens of others, sea people, swamp people, forest dwellers, nomads, were marched off to the almost center of the Great Plains and told to stay put, to civilize, to praise Jesus in English and farm as the white men farmed, and, above all, to be grateful for what they had. In the flood of injustice surging over the continent, Indian Territory was meant to be a small island of relief. The survivors of genocide could live there, unharassed and sovereign, as long as, to quote the famous treaty, grass shall grow and water run. By 1880, however, even this modest promise was under assault. It started right at the center of Indian Territory, on nearly 2 million acres of land that had belonged for 30 years to the Creek and Seminole Indians, a consolation prize for losing their ancestral homelands in Georgia and Florida. But then, for complex reasons, the tribes chose to side with the South during the Civil War. It was a losing gamble. As punishment, after the war, the United States government seized the land and gave it to nobody. It came to be known as the Unassigned Lands, a vacuum nearly half the size of Connecticut, right near the center of America. Vacuums, by nature, tend to get themselves filled, often with sudden violence. People in the neighboring states, Kansas, Texas, noticed the emptiness of the unassigned lands. They became obsessed with the place. They wanted to fill it. They lusted after it. They gave it a name, Oklahoma, Choctaw for red people. Some managed to convince themselves that Oklahoma was their destiny, that they were somehow entitled to it. Imagine their excitement. America's great promise in its early days was that it was the anti-Europe, an end